All right, so like I mentioned, we'll just do a quick review here to just get us caught up because it has been about 4 weeks or so since we last met up. And so again, Old Testament Survey 2, we're picking up in Joshua, all that, and getting kind of as far as we can, which hasn't been too far yet. We're just in Judges, so it's all good. So if you remember, kind of get us, again, up to speed real quick before we jump into Judges. Joshua, right? Book of Joshua. The theme we talked about is the God who conquers. And really what we saw was God conquering the promised land. And in that was showing his dominion, not just over the promised land, but really over creation as a whole, right? He is the one who all creation belongs to, and all creation is meant to point back to him and his glory. We saw that kind of established in like the Torah, especially in Genesis and all that. But we saw in Joshua him establishing Israel as a nation in the land in order that they would have that international impact, okay? That they would put God's agenda on display to the world around them, okay? To all the nations around them, they would put God's agenda on display. That agenda, again, that God really does own everything, okay? And that everything is supposed to point back to his glory. But if you remember in Joshua, what we started to see and then definitely started seeing in the book of Judges, what was the issue with that? You guys remember? What was the issue? God was putting them in there for a purpose and all that, this agenda. But what was the problem with that? Huh?
They didn't finish it
completely? Israel's the problem, right? Like, they're sinful. They're sinful. They keep failing. Like, and so one of the ways was in even conquering the land. They didn't fully do that. And again, Judges, we're seeing the ramifications of that. But you have this issue that they almost, like, can't handle the plan, right? This is God's plan, but they can't live up to it. And their sinfulness is going to lead to a crisis, okay? And so we started seeing those kind of fractures form in the nation, in the book of Joshua, and now in the book of Judges, we're seeing those kind of fractures turn into crises, right? Like, and that is what is unpacking. And so now that we're in Judges, if you remember, what we're going to see and kind of our theme that we talked about was the God who preserves his nation. And so that's what we're going to see, that despite their sinfulness, despite their failure to accomplish this plan, God is going to be faithful to preserve the nation, okay? And we talked about that even in this preserving, this preservation, there was a purpose, okay? There was a purpose behind this, that God is preserving them so that they can get a king, okay? That they can get a king. And so we've seen these promises back in, again, our study of the Torah, like in Genesis, with Genesis 3:13, Genesis 49:10, that there's going to come one who will be the true right king, who will redeem God's people, who will kind of get us back to this relationship with God, kind of reverse the curse of Genesis 3, right? Like all these things, there's going to be this one to come. And so God is preserving the nation so that this will still happen. Okay, but then also with that in Judges, what we see is not only is God preserving them, and in this we see like that they will get a king, but also in Judges you see why they need a king. Okay, God is establishing and showing this is why you need a king, and not just any king, you need the right king. Okay, you need the true king, and that's what we are seeing in the book of Judges. Okay. Because again, if you remember, what's the kind of common refrain throughout Judges? It was, there was no what in Israel. There was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was right in their own eyes, right? Like, and so that's really this common theme, is there is no king. And so this is just letting things kind of run rampant in Israel. All right. So let's see. So we're in Judges. And then again, just more specifically kind of review the first few chapters. We talk about like this is like the prologue, which is kind of the crisis begins. And throw stuff around. What you have in this first part of Judges is really this main idea that Israel's failures on both kind of a physical and spiritual level create a crisis that starts the need for a king. Okay, that Israel fails on a physical and spiritual level, and this creates a crisis that starts the need for a king. So we start really establishing that. And so, like, the physical level, that was really largely the failure, as was mentioned before, to not fully conquer the land, that they failed in that respect, that they were called to kind of keep the conquest going, keep filling the land, all that, but then they don't. They failed in that way. But then they also failed on the spiritual level to where what? They start going after other gods. They start serving and worshiping the gods of the nations. And so instead of being the nation that's impacting other nations, they're letting all the nations impact them. Okay, is really what's happening. And also in this, we started to see, and we talked about, like, there's the cycle of the judges, okay, where you essentially have idolatry. Okay, so Israel goes after other gods, giving over idolatry, and then they are punished, right? So punishment. So God sends a nation to punish them for this idolatry. So they are kind of oppressed, taken over during that time. Then you have the people cry out. So they cry for help. Lord, help us. We're getting oppressed by these people, all this stuff, right? And then you have the Lord raise up a judge, and so there's, like, deliverance. And even, like, some rest involved here, okay? Where God raises up a judge, a deliverer. That's what the name judge means, right? Like, it's a deliverer to rescue his people from these oppressions and all that. And then after they have that, they have rest, right? They have a little reprieve from this persecution, all that. But then you have the judge dies. Okay. And then, do you guys remember what happens after the judge dies? Back to idolatry, right? Like, so then we just start the circle all over again, the cycle. Okay, and this is really this cycle of judges, okay? So we have idolatry into kind of punishment, into them crying out. God delivers, they have rest, the judge dies, and then they return right back into the idolatry, okay? But if you remember, we also talked about, this is not only like a cyclical circle type of cycle, but it's also really a downward spiral, okay? Because all along the way, Israel keeps kind of getting worse, okay? And even the judges start to get worse, that, like, we're even going to see today, okay? Where some of the judges we've dealt with so far, we're kind of like, yeah, they're not like maybe standard of perfection, but they're all right. But today we're going to see, yeah, they're not great guys, okay? So they're not great guys. In all this. And that kind of ties in. So this next section is the crisis of leadership, and that's where we're in. But this is the main part of the book, and this is where we're talking about all these different judges, these deliverers. And the main point, kind of what we talked about, was described, is that God delivers his flawed people by flawed people in order to point to the need of a true king. Okay, so God delivers his flawed people, like the nation of Israel is flawed in themselves. They are sinful. They're wicked. And so he delivers his flawed people by flawed people, right? These judges, as we're going to see, were not great guys, and a lot of them were pretty terrible, actually. But God uses them, and this is to point to the need of a true king, okay? And we even talked about just the reality that God, in using these flawed individuals, that even in their, despite their sinful actions, all these things, God uses them to preserve his nation, to accomplish his purposes. This was ultimately to show who is the ultimate hero in all this. God, right? It's not these guys. It's not these individuals. Like, we don't read these and think, oh man, Samson, he deserves all the glory, right? Like, at least maybe you think that, but wait till we get to it, right? And like, no, because what? Ultimately, who's doing all the work here? It's God, okay? And he's the one who should get all the glory from this, okay? All right. And so we started this, right, where we looked at kind of the first few judges. We saw Othniel, Ehud, Shamgar, and then Deborah and Barak. And so we've kind of covered those already. And one of the running themes that we've kind of mentioned was also one of the weaknesses of these judges, and really showed that they are not the true king, was their failure to be able to unite Israel as a whole. Okay, that you see these tensions of Israel, like these judges not being able to rally the nation as a whole together to make, to fight these fights, to fight these battles. And so that's going to start unpacking later on of how do you, what's a characteristic of a true king? It's one who could unite the nation as well. Okay. All right. So that's kind of our little review. That brings us into where we left off before, and that is with the judge Gideon. Okay, so if you have your Bibles, you can turn to chapter 6 of Judges. So that's where we'll pick up. So chapters 6 through 8 is the account of Gideon. And what you need to understand about the account of Gideon is this is all about trusting God. Okay, this is all about trusting God. And the question for Gideon is really, do you understand that God is with you? And will you trust him? Do you understand that God is with you? And will you trust him? And really, this is the question not just for Gideon, but for Israel as a whole. Okay, this is for Israel as a nation too. Do you understand that God is with you? And will you trust him? Okay, and this again ties us back to our study of the Torah, where we saw, like in the patriarchs, these foundational truths, these values that would be part of the nation as a whole. And we saw, like in the life of Isaac and Jacob, one of the main things was that God is with them. God is with you as a nation, Israel. And so it's really this coming back to that to say, like, Israel, do you believe that? That God is actually with you? And if he is, will you trust him? And that's what we're going to see this emphasis throughout the account of Gideon, okay? All right, so the cycle continues, okay? Talks about verse 1 there of chapter 6. People of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. So we have our idolatry, right? All that. But then we see the punishment, okay? God sends the Midianites to come and kind of take over. But then you see the next step, they cry out. But notice real quick in verses 8 through 10 of chapter 6, there's kind of an interesting thing here where when the people cry out, the Lord actually sends a prophet, like he sends someone to really call them out. Okay, he sends someone to call them out for their continual rebellion against God, right? And again, not trusting him and all that. And really, the Lord here points back to like the Exodus and the conquest to show the people he has been continually faithful to be with them. All right, he's like, I've been faithful to you, with you all the time, and I'm able to deliver you and do all this, but you just are not listening, right? They keep going through this cycle, right? They are not listening. They continue to disobey. But, and this is what we see, like God is still gracious, right? God is still preserving his nation. He is still gracious to them despite their disobedience, despite their continual rebellion. He is gracious, and in the process, he raises up our next judge, Gideon. Okay? And look at verse 12 of chapter 6 here, and the angel of the Lord comes to Gideon here. Verse 12. And notice, what does he say to Gideon right off the bat? What's like the first words he says with him? Yeah, the Lord is with you. Okay, so again, that theme right there, this question of, do you believe that, right? The angel of the Lord comes and says, the Lord is with you, like right away declaring that. And to see that Gideon really struggles to trust that, look at verse 13. What does he say in verse 13? Catch what he says. What's his first question? Huh? Why is it all happening? Yeah, he says, notice, he says, if the Lord is with us, why then has all this happened to us? Okay, so right away he questions this very basic concept that the Lord is with us. He says, if God is really with us, why are we being oppressed? Why is this even happening? Okay. And so you see right away, he's struggling to trust the Lord here. And we're going to keep seeing that throughout. He's going to have this struggle. And so, but God confirms, like, I'm going to use you to deliver the people from the Midianites. I'm going to be faithful to bring that about. And then Gideon, again, in this struggle of trusting God, he wants a sign, okay? He wants a sign that this is really the Lord speaking to him and all that. And so the angel instructs him, okay, go grab some meat and bread and broth and stuff and bring it back here. And so Gideon grabs that stuff. Angel instructs him, hey, pour the broth all over the meat and the bread and all that. And then the angel touches the food and it just consumes, right? It's like goes up in flames, right? And Gideon then knows, okay, this is God, okay? Like, all right, fine. I trust it, right? But again, you see, he's still struggling to trust the Lord. And so God then gives him kind of this first initial task. So he's, again, the overall task is to deliver the people from the Midianites. So deal with that. But he gives him kind of a smaller task first. Do you remember what he instructs him to do? By chance? All your Bible trivia.
Not yet.
Like the opposite of that. Yeah, so tear down. So in his town, right, like in his little hometown there, they have an altar to Baal, to Baal. And he says, hey, go tear that down and cut down the Asheroth and all of that, okay? And again, if you think of in the maybe ranges of like, okay, let me like lead an army to defeat like the Midianites or tear down this altar. This is kind of like, okay, let's like practice. Here we go. Let's get this going. And does he do it? Does he actually do it? Does he follow through? Yeah, he does it, right? He does it. So that's okay, that's good, Gideon. But it says he did it at night, right? So it's like no one noticed, right? Like no one sees him do it. Okay, he's not bold and courageous to like, I'm just going to tear down the middle of the day and all that. Like, now I'm just going to kind of sneak around at night and do it, right? So, but at least he does it. Okay, so that's a thing. But we still see, again, he's struggling to trust the Lord and believe that the Lord is with him. Okay? But he accomplishes this. So now we're moving back to our bigger task, which is to deliver the Israelites from the Midianites. And this is where then you get the kind of the sign of the fleece, right? Where he does this whole thing of, again, trusting the Lord, where he kind of is like, okay, if you really want me to do this, all that, like, can you give me another sign? Okay, and he says, like, I'm going to lay my fleece out overnight, and if only the fleece is like has dew on it and nothing else, then okay, I know this is what you're calling me to do. And so, okay, God does it, right? So he goes on next morning, only the fleece is wet, everything else is dry, all that, okay? But then is that enough for him? No, he wants to do it again, right? He's like, okay, well, maybe I have like a super absorbent fleece. So let's do like the opposite now of only the fleece is dry, everything else is covered in dew, all that. And God does it again, okay? So he gives into that, right? Like he allows him to do that. And so then finally at that point, Gideon kind of is starting to trust the Lord, okay? But again, you see, he's testing the Lord twice to really move toward what God has called him to, okay? So again, he's struggling to trust the Lord. And then that leads into, okay, now we're prepping for this battle for against the Midianites, okay? So he's like, okay, I'll do it. I'll go gather an army and do all this, okay? And this is such a great part of Judges, actually. Okay, so if you remember, so he goes to gather his army for the Midianites. And remember, the emphasis is all about, do you trust God? And he ends up with actually 32,000 men. Okay, so 32,000 men is a pretty good army, all that. But then do you remember what the Lord says is the issue with that?
Too many.
Yeah, so that's too many, all right? Because why? Because it's too many because if they win, they're just going to say, well, it's through our might that we did it. All right? It was because of us, because of our military strength, because we had our 32,000 men. That's why we did it. It wasn't God, it was us. And so God is essentially like, that's way too many. We need to cut this down a little bit to show that, like, no, it's, you need to trust me, okay, not your military might. And so the first kind of narrowing down here, do you guys remember the first narrowing down? How they get rid of some people? Yeah, it's like if anyone's scared, you can go home, okay? And that's actually like part of the Mosaic Law. Deuteronomy chapter 20, verse 8 actually talks about that. If you have people who are scared, like let them go, right? Like let them go home. And so you have this first group that like, yeah, if you're scared, go home, okay? Which, I don't know, you can almost view that as like the normal people, right? Like, it's kind of like, I don't know if any of you would be like, yeah, let's go. You're like, okay, I'll go home. That's cool. Like, that's nice. And so it's kind of the normal people, maybe. They're kind of like, okay, I'll just go home. And 22,000 of them go home, okay? That's the, you could say, yeah, that's the normal people. That makes sense. So you're left with 10,000. So they just lost like two-thirds. So again, if you're picturing Gideon, he's probably getting a little nervous, right? Oh, that's a little more than I was saying. Thinking like a few hundred might have left, not two-thirds of my people. And if you think about like, okay, like these 10,000 people who are left, probably you have like kind of primarily two groups of people, right? You have, on the one hand, you probably have the like special ops, like I was born for this, I'm ready to fight, right? Like I'm a warrior, all that. But then you probably have, okay, if you have the normal people who left because they're like scared, you probably just have also like the crazy people that are oblivious to like, I've always wanted to handle a sword. This is going to be awesome, right? Like, and let's get it. Let's go. And so you probably have this extreme, right? You have the trained warriors and you have the crazy people that just don't really know what they're getting themselves into, right? And so God still says, what? This 10,000 is still too many, right? Still too many. Let's narrow it down more. And so they go to the spring, and God is going to tell Gideon, like, hey, you're going to have them drink from the spring, and depending on, like, how they drink, we're going to divide them into two groups, and you have to, like, take the group I say you need to take, right? Which, in hindsight, you're like, oh, man, okay, what's he choosing? And so they go down the spring, right? And you have the two different types of people, okay? So it talks about, he says, separate the people who lap the water with their tongue like a dog laps, and then those who kneel down to drink, okay? So those are kind of the two groups you have there, okay? And so how does a dog lap water? Yeah, they like put their face in it, right? Like they're on all fours. Okay, a dog's not getting their cup out or something and all that. They're on all fours, essentially put their face in the water and drink the water, okay? And so that's really why you have this one group, right? You have this picture of these guys who are just almost like dunking their head in the water and all that, drinking, okay? Just like maybe a dog would or an animal would. And then you have the people who would kneel, okay? And so kind of this idea would be you're kneeling down and probably scooping the water to your mouth. Okay, is kind of this idea. And so, if you think about it, right, what does this say about these two groups? All right, if we have our like groups of the crazy people and the special ops people, who would be the ones kind of kneeling down and bring the water to themselves? Like the special ops, right? Like you're more alert, right? Like you're aware. You're looking out. If you're just dunking your head in the water, what does that do? Like, your enemy could just come up and attack you, right? Like, easy target. And so there's the alertness there, okay? And so the ones dunking, kind of lapping the water, all that, are kind of the crazy people. The text, right, it gets kind of confusing because it says those lapping the water, who bring their hand to their mouth or something, like that's created kind of weird. And probably the idea is like as they're like dunking their head in the water, they're just bringing the water in, right? Like that's kind of what they're doing, okay? And so then which group does God choose for Gideon to take? The kneelers or the lappers? The lappers, right? He chooses the lappers, the crazy people, right? So Gideon, right, probably thinking like, oh my goodness, right, like What have you given me? And how many of those are there? 300. All right. So he went from 32,000 down to 300. Okay. And again, the fact that he's choosing kind of the crazy, not special ops, he will also make sense because, again, remember the context. What is God trying to get across? Do you trust me? Right? Because what? Even if it was 300, if it was only 300, but if it was like your special ops, best of the best Rambo guys running out there, what? They could still say, this was us. Right? Like, you can think of the 300 Spartans, right? Like, they can, 300 can still do a lot, right? But if it's just these crazy people that are like, I got my sword, I'm ready, right? Like, all that, then what? It's all God. Okay? And to further confirm this, I think their battle strategy even confirms it's really not the special ops people, right? Because as they prepare these guys for battle, do they give them like swords and shields and all that? No, like here's a trumpet, right? Like you get a trumpet and some jars, right? With some torches in them. Okay, so they're not even trusted with a sword. They're just, let's not give you a weapon. Okay? And so kind of the plan they have, right, is they surround the camp of the Midianites and the Amalekites are there with them as well. And so they surround it. And the idea is when they blow the trumpets, they smash all the jars and all the torches are lit up and all that. And when they do that, what? The Lord kind of sends them, the Midianites, into a frenzy where they all essentially start attacking themselves. Okay, so again, you can picture these crazy guys that are just like, we're doing it! And they're not doing anything, right? Like, it's just they're kind of attacking each other. And then eventually they flee, the Midianites flee, and then they chase after them, okay? So they chase after them. Gideon summons some of the other tribes to come and pursue the Midianites and capture more of the land, okay? So God is delivering them through Gideon, okay? But as you come into chapter 8, you begin to, again, see this disunity of the nation on display, okay? Because in the first half, you see the tribe of Ephraim. They get mad at Gideon because they weren't assembled to fight against Midian and all that. Okay, they're like, why weren't we included in all this? And I mean, God wanted small numbers anyways, right? So they're mad, but eventually that gets solved. But then you even have a couple of the cities of Israel refusing to help Gideon along the way, like by even just providing provisions of like, hey, we're exhausted, all that we need, like supplies. And they said, no, like, you haven't captured anyone yet. You haven't defeated Midian yet. Like, why would we give you stuff, right? And that eventually leads to Gideon going back and attacking them and stuff. And so you see essentially kind of like a little mini civil war kind of break out here. Not full-scale civil war in the nation, but you're seeing these kind of mini civil wars, okay, where Gideon and his army is even attacking Israel itself. Okay, and so not a good situation that's arising here. And again, it comes back to that reality of, is Gideon the true king? No, right? He can't unite the nation. And even kind of an interesting thing on top of that, in verse 22 of chapter 8, what do the people want to do with Gideon? See that there? Yeah, they want to make him king. Okay, verse 22, it says, the men of Israel said to Gideon, rule over us, you and your son and your grandson also, for you have saved us from the hand of Midian. So they want to make him king. Like, oh, this is pretty great. Let's make you king, all that. And what does Gideon respond? Yeah, he actually refuses, right? Like, to his credit, he actually refuses. Okay, he says no. And he at least recognizes he is not the king, but he says what? But the Lord will rule over you. And so he points to the Lord and everything. And so at least that's one bright spot in Gideon's thing. But it's interesting because as we go on after this, right after that, what does he ask the people to do? He says, hey, let's get some of the spoil you guys got. Give me all your gold earrings, all that. And he makes a golden ephod out of that. And what does that sound like to you? Yeah, the golden calf incident. If you remember back in Exodus 32, the incident of the golden calf that we saw in the Torah, where the people took like the spoil of the Exodus, all that, and Aaron's like, hey, give me all your gold and all that, and he makes a golden calf. And it sounds very similar, right? And that's on purpose, because it's essentially supposed to be kind of a deja vu moment of this is just like the golden calf, okay? But this is to show you how bad Gideon and the people are at this time, that they can do this kind of deja vu moment with one of the most heinous events in Israel's history, and they don't even catch it, right? They don't even catch it. But that's what they do, right? They do this, and it says like it becomes like a stumbling block to them and all that as well, okay? All right. So have that. So again, showing Gideon is not like the right guy, all that. But then notice also how this chapter ends, because even though Gideon refused to become king over the people, it says what? He ends up kind of like acting like a king a little bit though. Okay. So verse 30 mentions that he has 70 sons and many wives, which again was common practice of like the ancient Near East kings of that time. They'd have their large harem and have many sons. But if you remember, was this a good thing according to the law? No. Remember our three G's, the gold, gals, and Gideon, right? Kings were not supposed to multiply wives. And so even like a true king would not be acting like he is. Okay. But then in verse 31, it says one of his concubines bears him a son. And do you know what he names him? Yeah, Abimelech. Do you guys know what Abimelech means? It means my father is king, okay? So if you're saying I'm not the king and then you name your son my father is king, a little fishy, right? That's a little strange and stuff. So even though he kind of refused that of the people, he's still kind of acting like it, okay? That's what's going on. And we're going to see some of these kind of, again, things that kind of seeds he's planting here are going to kind of come to fruition here in this next chapter as well, okay? But what we see, right, he wasn't a very godly guy, okay? And despite his actions, he was not the true king of Israel, right? He was not the true king, and eventually Gideon dies, okay? He dies. And that leads into then chapter 9, where we get a little bit more focus on his son Abimelech here. And we see kind of the seeds planted in Gideon's life are now coming to fruition in his son. And this account's interesting, this chapter, because Abimelech's not a judge. Okay, he's not a judge, but we have this focus on him. And again, I think the point is we're just seeing how bad the situation was at the time of Gideon. And again, all of this is kind of unfolding because of even his actions, okay? And so, again, we saw this individual, Abimelech, at the end of chapter 8. His name means my father is king. And even though that was odd for Gideon to name him that because he refused to be king, all that, what do we see about Abimelech? What does he want? Yeah, he wants to be king. Okay, where it's like, well, my dad maybe didn't fully want it, but I want it. Okay, I want to be king. And he tries to attain this through sinful and treacherous means. He convinces the leaders of the town of Shechem, which I've heard like one of my professors describe that Shechem was like the city of covenants and treachery. Okay, where you have covenant renewals happen a lot at Shechem, but then you also have a lot of treacherous things happen at Shechem. This is one of the treacherous ones. So Abimelech gets the leaders of Shechem on his side, and they give him money and stuff, support him, so that it says he can go hire some worthless and reckless fellows. And they go and do what? Do you remember what they go and do? Yeah, they go and kill all his brothers. Remember, there are 70 sons, and so how does he try to like guarantee, like, I'm going to be the one to take over for my dad and be the king? Well, if I kill all of them, I'm the only one left, right? That's how it works. And so he goes and kills all of them except for one. All right, one brother survives, the youngest, Jotham. He survives, but he kills, what, like 68 people, right, through this. So, again, not a good guy, okay? Not a good guy with all this. But the youngest, Jotham, he escapes this plot and everything, and then he ends up cursing Abimelech and the leaders of Shechem for their treachery and all that. And we see the rest of the chapter is essentially that curse playing itself out, okay? That Abimelech and the leaders of Shechem have a falling out, and Abimelech ends up killing all of them and, like, destroying the city. That's where they, like, go into their tower, and he, like, burns it down and all that with them in it. So that doesn't end well. But then you still have to have, well, what about Abimelech? He continues to try to expand his control. So he goes and attacks the town of Thebes. And the city goes into their stronghold. And just like he did with Shechem before, I'm going to go burn this tower down as well. As he's close to the wall, it says that a certain woman just throws a millstone over the wall and it lands on his head, right? Crushes his head. And with his kind of last gasp of consciousness, he asks his armor bearer to, like, kill him so that they can't say I was killed by a woman, right? That's kind of his last thing. And so the armor bearer does it. He dies. And then notice in verse 55, like, when he dies, kind of the reaction of all the people with him, it says, well, like, and when the men of Israel saw that Abimelech was dead, everyone departed to his home, right? It's just kind of like, well, I guess we're done here, right? Like, let's just leave. And so, again, not a great situation. And so God brings to fruition Jotham's curse on both the leaders of Shechem and on Abimelech, okay? But again, don't miss here the reality that this is another mini civil war within Israel, right? Nowhere, this isn't like, yeah, this is, they're attacking each other, doing all this. And so not only is Israel collapsing because of foreign forces, but also from attacking itself, right? So that's why it's collapsing. And so the situation in Israel is bad, okay? We're continuing in this downward spiral. It's continuing on, okay? All right. And then we come into chapter 10, and kind of sandwiched in between kind of the larger accounts of Gideon and Abimelech and then Jephthah on the other end here, we see a couple brief accounts of the next two judges of Tola and Jair. And so similar to we saw like Shamgar before, where we just had like a verse on a hymn, we see kind of a similar thing here, just very brief descriptions of these two judges. And so we'll just point out a couple things here. So first we have Tola. It says he is from the tribe of Issachar and he lived in the hill country of Ephraim. And it just states that he judged Israel for 23 years, and then he died and was buried, and that's it, right? That's all we got, okay? And then we have Jair, who is a Gileadite. So from, like, the east side of the Jordan, that's Gilead, and we'll see that kind of come up with Jephthah here in a moment. Says he judged Israel 22 years, and he died and was buried. And the only additional detail that we have about Jair is that he had 30 sons who rode on donkeys, okay? You're like, well, that seems a random tidbit there for us. But it's actually pretty significant, right? Because what, like, this vast number of sons sounds a little bit like who? Gideon, right? And this idea of kind of probably then had multiple wives. Again, someone kind of acting like a king in a sense. And then even this riding on the donkeys supports this because a person riding on a donkey in that time was often viewed as like kind of like a symbol of royalty, okay, or like a king doing this. And so that's what he's kind of declaring about his sons and all that. And again, if you zoom ahead many, many years later, Jesus rides into Jerusalem on what? A donkey, right? At what event? What do we call that? Remember what we call that? Yeah, the triumphal entry, right? And so right before his death, that's, again, this Matthew is picturing him as this kind of conquering king coming in. And so he's riding on a donkey to symbolize that, okay? And so we see this connection of donkeys and royalty and all that. And we see this even in the Old Testament kind of building up here, okay? All right. And again, so the fact that Jair had his sons riding on donkeys likely points to this view of himself as a king. But just like with Gideon, is he the true king? No. Right? He dies, all that, okay? And also something interesting else here to mention, kind of briefly here in these verses, is if you remember our cycle here, of kind of our judges cycle, normally after the judge delivered, we also had this element of rest, right, in the land. But in these verses of these judges, we don't have any mentioning of that, okay, that there is no rest. And in the context of Shamgar, we saw that before, it also didn't mention rest. But what I think is significant here is that even like with the rest of the judges, the remaining judges throughout the book, it's never mentioned again, right? There's no more rest mentioned. Like even at least Gideon, like it mentioned there was rest in the land, all that. But from Tola, like these judges on, there's like no more rest, okay? And so we see like this transition that occurred like in Gideon and with Abimelech, that this kind of transition occurs in Israel, that there's really no genuine peace anymore, right? Like that's happening. It was not a reality anymore. And so again, we've moved further down the spiral and things are just getting worse, right? To where there isn't even rest now in the nation, okay? All right, and it takes us to Jephthah, but before we get there, we'll take a little break to come up for some air and all that. Mm-hmm.